your two presenters today. Again, we are going to be joined by Emerald or Emmy Laha from EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, as well as Robert Pope from EPA Region 4. And I think just perhaps in the interest of time, I'll go ahead and turn things over to Emmy right now so that she can give everyone a brief introduction to this series. Emmy, can we get started?
Sure. Hi, everyone. This is Emmy Laha. I'm with the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office at EPA headquarters. And we want to share some information on the Federal Facilities Academy. As Jean mentioned, this is the first session in that series. But you might be asking yourself, well, what is this academy? So it's voluntary, number one. There's no requirement to participate. But these trainings were developed for EPA RPMs, remedial project managers, project managers from other federal agencies, state governments, tribal representatives, essentially anyone who has an interest in federal facility cleanups. We developed a set of 11 webinars that really have a federal facilities focus, and there's also a 12th course, which is an in-person course. And if you complete all of these trainings, you can earn a certificate of completion that'll come from EPA headquarters to recognize the additional work that you've put in into better understanding how federal facilities are cleaned up under Superfund. So on your screen, you'll see a list of dates. This is the first session that we're offering, so I'm very excited to hear any feedback you all might have at the end of this training. And we're offering them about monthly. Again, if you can't make an offering once it's being offered live, you can see the archived version, which will be posted a couple of days after the event, and earn credit that way. And we'll talk, Jean will talk a little bit more about how you earn credit or your certificate of completion, I should say your certificates for each individual course in just a second. But FIFRO is very excited to be rolling this out. We see it as a good way to increase understanding across the various groups that work on federal facility cleanups so that even though we might not always agree on everything, we have a mutual understanding of where we're starting from and then can work from there to get to cleanup decisions in our program. So I'll pause there. And Jean, would you like to talk about the certificates and earning credit?
Absolutely. So we'll just try to make this as clear as we can for everyone. So as Emmy has pointed out, this is part of a series that will include 11 online webinars, which are open to the public, and then one classroom delivery, which has a limited audience. For the online webinars, which are open to the public, you may participate in these webinars live, just like we're doing right now, or if you're unable to attend one of the seminars completely or at any point live, we'll have a recorded version that you can replay online. So it doesn't matter if you come live or you replay the recorded version for the online webinars. Either method will allow you to complete those sessions. For the in-person classroom training, which has a restricted audience, this is open only to EPA, state regulators, tribes, and other federal agencies. For that particular course, which will be scheduled at a later date, you will only be able to participate if you're able to attend in person. So I just want to be sure that you understand that that does have a restricted audience. But you're still able to get sort of credit regardless of which portion of the series you're able to attend. So if you happen to be able to only take the individual online public webinars, for in any or all of these online public webinars, you can earn or get a certificate of completion for each one in the series. So at the end of each one of these webinars, I'll explain how you can fill out an easy form online and either download or print out one of these certificates. So at a minimum, you can walk away, whether you play it back online as a recorded version or you're here for the live webinar, you'll get at least 11 individual certificates for those. And then for those of you that are eligible to also take that in-person classroom training, and you're able to complete that in-person classroom training, after you have successfully done all of the online webinars and attended the in-person classroom training, you'll be able to earn an Academy certificate, which reflects your ability to take all 12, the 11 online webinars and the one in-person delivery. And if that causes any of confusion, we are also available to help talk to you and answer any questions you might have at the end of the webinar today. All right, Emmy, feel free to begin.
Great. So let's go ahead and get started. We're covering determining land use and on-site, off-site determinations, but we'll first start with the land use discussion. And we're looking at how determining land use really plays into CERCLA, or the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. A lot of acronyms typically in our material, so we'll try and make sure we hit on each of those. But before we jump into the slides or the actual text, I'd like to ask the group a couple of questions as far as what you've experienced when trying to determine land use for a site. So can we start with that first question, Jean? And the first question is going to be asking, when selecting a CERCLA remedy at a federal facility, who determines the reasonably anticipated land use? We can see some of the answers coming in. There's a chunk in all of the above. There's also some in the lead cleanup agency are our front runners so far. Okay, still a few more coming in. Oh, we got a couple of votes now for the state. We'll give you just a few more moments to get your answer in, and then we'll
discuss.
And if
you've never done one of these polls, you'll see a circle next to each one of the options that are there. So this is a pick one sort of poll. So just click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct in this situation. And if you happen to be in a group, you'll have to debate it amongst yourselves to kind of agree on one collective answer to respond. All right, Emmy, what do you want to pause now and talk a little bit about this one?
Sure. So just looking at the results that are on the screen, we have the majority of responses, 63% in all of the above. And I would agree with that answer, that it really is a group effort. No one agency should be making this land use determination in a vacuum. There was a couple of votes. The one that came in second was the lead cleanup agency. I think I could understand why people would vote for that, since that lead cleanup agency is responsible for implementing the cleanup on the site. But when it comes to determining land use, it really requires the involvement of all the parties to get to that decision. And we're going to talk a lot more about this throughout the slides, so no worries with whatever answer you provided there. So here's a second question for you all, and this one is, can the land use determination at a federal facility change? All right, it looks like we are at 100% for votes tallied so far as yes. And yes, I would agree, the land use determination at a federal facility site can change. We had maybe some votes for no, but we're going to discuss this all in more detail. But that makes sense. You might have assumed an industrial land use at your site, and if condos start going up there, well, your land use has changed, right? The assumptions you made in a cleanup that was protective under industrial scenarios is not the same as it would be for a residential scenario. So we'll talk more about that on the next couple of slides. We just wanted to start with some questions to get your mind in the game, so to speak, for the material we'll be covering today. So let's go ahead and go on to the next slide. Give me a second to get there. There we go. So there's different types of land use that can be determined, right? Some examples are recreational use, agricultural, industrial, or residential use. And these are important to know because it's going to get to how people are being exposed to any materials that might have been left on site. So how is the land being used, essentially, or how is it anticipated to be used in the future? There's a variety of answers to what that may be, depending on the specifics of your site. So land use determinations are very much an important part of CERCLA because it's going to help you develop your remedial action objectives, or your REOs. So your REOs are going to help determine just how much remediation is done at a site, because those are going to impact assumptions that deal with exposures. What is the duration of exposure? What is the frequency of exposure? And that, in turn, will inform the remedies that are considered for that site and ultimately the remedy that you're going to select. So all very important, starting from this upfront decision of determining what land use is at the site. It really informs all components of the CERCLA process. One thing to keep in mind is that community involvement has a critical role. It's a conversation that you want to start early. I had mentioned before that land use determinations aren't really an agency making a decision in a vacuum. It's a much broader discussion with the impacted parties. So that's going to include having that conversation with interested parties across your community. That it plays a critical role because it's also going to affect the amount of confidence that the public has in the decisions that you're making at a site. And well, we're going to talk more about what information you should consider, but just being aware it's not a single agency or only federal and state agencies. It is a part of a broader conversation that should be happening when it comes to determining land use. Another factor to keep in mind is that how you got to that determination, the process, any effort need to be documented in the site's administrative record.
Emmy, we did have a comment just to, before you go any further, and I thought it might be a great time to just talk about this. One of the participants stated that there's a difference between stating a view on future land use and then having the legal authority to determine the future land use. For example, EPA can't tell the Air Force to change the land use of a military base. So I was wondering perhaps for some of our participants who are new, can you talk a little bit about the difference between stating a view on use versus having legal authority to determine its use?
Right. So for a military base or somewhere where there's very defined uses, be it residential or barracks or a range, right, that is not EPA's role to come in and say this is what the land use is going to be for this area or for this site. So that's a good clarification to make. It really comes down to looking at how is it anticipated that land is going to be used moving forward. We have some examples throughout the course that we'll elaborate on. For example, if you have land that's surrounded by industrial activities, more than likely that area may also be used for industrial activities. If you have a plot of land that's completely surrounded by residential use, and you're making an argument that, no, this should be industrial land use, well, does that make sense in the broader picture? So I hope I didn't overspeak in trying to say that EPA would tell other agencies what their land use is, but it is a group conversation to make sure we're all on the same page in making that determination. Were there any other comments that came in, Jean?
Just that other people were kind of chiming in that it would be really useful to clarify who's making that decision. So a number of people appreciated that you were clarifying that definition.
And we have a couple of slides that will clarify it further. But again, please come chime in with any questions you have as we go so we can make sure they're addressed. Does it make sense when we're on that particular topic? All right, I'm going to continue to the next slide. This is regarding the specific guidance documents that we're going to be spending the majority of today focusing on as far as land use. So the first one is from 1995. It is the Land Use and CERCLA Remedy Selection Process. You'll hear us refer to it as the Land Use Directive. Then there's the Reuse Assessments, a tool to implement the Superfund Land Use Directive from 2001. And then we have a guidance from 2010. Granted, it's not specific to federal facilities, but there's still a lot of good information in that we would like to highlight. That the 2010 guidance is considering reasonably anticipated future land use and reducing barriers to reuse at EPA-led Superfund remedial sites. So let's go ahead and get started with the first piece of guidance, which is the Land Use Directive. In this guidance, it speaks to how discussions with local land use planning authorities, local officials, and the public really should be conducted as early as possible in the scoping phase of your remedial investigation and feasibility study, your RIFS. So why would you talk to these groups of local people? Well, they probably have a lot of information that's going to be very useful in determining land use at your site. Host these conversations through public meetings or other avenues for discussion with community members, And it could be talking about things like zoning laws. What are the population growth patterns expected for that area? Are there natural resources that need to be considered? What, if any, are institutional controls that are in place or planning to be put in place for that site that could impact how the land is used? So you really need to have a good idea of all of this information when going forward in this early part of the RAFS process to determine your anticipated land use. Now, I'm not saying go out and write a thesis on the topic, right? But you should, the information is probably already available. You just need to speak with the right people to bring that information to the table. You want to be very well informed on making this determination for what the land use is going to be at your site. Then again, the consideration of anticipated future land use should be documented in your administrative record. So what discussions were had? Were there any, you know, meeting notes or summaries or other products, a letter or a white paper or what have you that you can include in your administrative record to help support that you had these conversations, not within a single agency or EPA and a federal agency or with the state, but actually had a much broader conversation that involved stakeholders in the conversation in determining what that land use would be. So that's what the guidance gets to. We'll proceed to the next slide. Still talking about the land use directive. That informs future land use assumptions are going to make sure that your baseline risk assessment is done in a way that allows for alternatives to be developed as part of your feasibility study that are practicable and cost effective for what makes sense at the site. So you have a clear picture from the get-go of the direction you're moving in going forward. And you want to be able to consider all the available land types. Like you might, your mission or your agency might say, no, this is absolutely going to be this land use. Okay, well, let's look at the broader picture. Having these conversations with the stakeholders will be really important. What if the city has plans to make a recreation park or an industrial park in that area? What if there's plans to develop housing because growth patterns are just blowing up in that part of the state? I mean, having those conversations are going to make sure all the appropriate possible future land uses are considered. So we have an example of that here on the next slide, and this is a NASA site at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And if you look on the top picture on the left-hand side of your screen, I'm not sure how big it is for you, there's a little red dot. I'm going to get my arrow. I'm going to try and get my arrow. Anyways, there we go. So this little red dot is where the JPL is located. And the primary land use in the area surrounding the site was residential and light commercial. So when NASA was moving forward with its CERCLA process, they used the baseline risk assessment that evaluated a commercial worker, a construction worker, as well as a hypothetical on-facility resident. So they weren't anticipating anyone would ever actually live on the site, let alone be exposed to the soils on the site, but they did that as part of their human health risk line base assessment to develop a very conservative scenario and to ensure that whatever remedy they selected would be protective. So again, they looked at their site, looked at the land use in the surrounding area, decided to be more conservative in their assumptions and considerations for the site, and then it worked out. They were comfortable with where they landed as far as the remedy selected for that site. Okay, so that's just one example. Coming back to the land use directive, in general, your REOs, remedial action objectives, should be developed in order to develop alternatives that are going to achieve cleanup levels that reflect what your anticipated future land use is over as much of the site as possible. There might be cases where this is pretty certain, where you pretty much know. Like, for example, if you have a landfill, that's going to be a long-term waste management area. You're not going to expect to build a house on top of that landfill or to use that land for any other type of use. So in situations like that, it's a little more clear. And we have an example of that we want to share. Granted, this isn't an MPL site or a Superfund site, but it talks about being certain of what your future land use is going to be. So this is Mount Trashmore. It's located near downtown Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It's very large. At its base, it's about 65 acres, and it's about 216 feet tall. So a very large landfill. As you can see here, while the land use hasn't changed, the owners of this area did allow for some recreational use to occur at the site. So granted, you know what your anticipated future land use is, where there are opportunities to incorporate reuse. That's something EPA is very, very supportive of in our Superfund program, so also something to consider. But again, this is being presented just as an example when you're pretty certain that your land, your anticipated future land use is not going to change anytime soon, if ever. Continuing on to the next slide, I'm going to hand it over to Rob.
Okay, thanks, Emmy. So for those of us that work on federal facilities, we have, many of us worked on base closures. The base realignment and closure effort that started in the 90s had a big impact on DOD facilities. And also some DOE facilities have closed and changed their use. So, you know, we have to think about these things as we're working on these base closures, that the land use assumptions that we started with may be very different if the federal agency is not maintaining control of the facility, or if they're transferring it to another federal agency even, or to a state or to a city. Some things that have happened, we've had Army bases turned into movie studios. We've had several sites turned into nature preserves, some given to Fish and Wildlife, still some still managed by other parts of the federal government agency that it started with. So those are some things you have to take into consideration. And we're going to have a couple of examples we'll talk about here. So you have to keep that in mind. You have to say, well, is it going to stay with DOD or DOE or the other agency? And if it transfers, there are usually these base closure realignment commissions that we're working with, and we can talk to them about zoning and what needs to be done for certain pieces of the land, because most of the facilities we work on, there are pieces that really don't have contamination on them and that can be easily transferred and reused for multiple purposes, but we have to be careful about the operable units that lay between those pieces, that they are treated correctly and zoned correctly. Okay. Let me get that. All right, there we go. So here's an example of one in South Carolina, Myrtle Beach Air Force Base, that has been almost completely redone. It was slated for closure really back in the 90s. Just to give you an idea, this was a facility that was a fairly major Air Force base. It's almost 4,000 acres. At this point, they turned what the Air Force base part of it into a international airport. So now when you want to go to coastal South Carolina, you can fly to the Myrtle Beach Airport and land on it, their runway. And it is mainly the original Air Force runway, and is now available for commercial flights. They have a whole bunch of new homes there, so some of the base housing was redone, and some of it they just built new housing. It's full of parks and walking paths and these sporting facilities. The existing golf course, because as we know, almost every military base has or had a golf course at one point, it seems like, was converted and is now a commercial golf course. They have moved one of the colleges there, and classes are taught in classroom building there, and they have an industrial park. And that's pretty common for these military facilities that are transferred, is that there's a lot of really excellent buildings there, and the chance to lay out an industrial park in a very new way with not a whole lot of interferences. So they have a new technology and aerospace business park that's centered around the idea of it being an airport, as well as a commercial district. And early on, this was not an MPL site. It was a RCRA cleanup site, and early on it was both EPA and the state of South Carolina worked with Department of Air Force to get this closed, but then at some point the state of South Carolina, I don't remember the exact year, they got their RCRA corrective action authority, and so they have been the lead for some time as EPA stepped out of the picture and this all got completed. But that's just an example of what can happen with these base realignment and closure facilities. So we're talking a little bit now about reuse assessments. There's EPA guidance on reuse assessments. So, but when another federal agency is doing a remedial action or a non-time critical removal action, we still want those assumptions that Emmy has already talked about the reasonably anticipated future land use, to be part of that and to go with the Superfund Land Use Directive, which is really about our private sites. And this is very important. It's important on private sites and federal facilities. You know, if a site is already an industrial site and we think it's going to stay an industrial site, that really impacts how we look at possible exposures to that site and how we do a risk assessment and what level of cleanup we might do. If we think the site is going to become a residential site or be reused for recreational purposes, that makes us look at different types of exposures and makes us think about different types of cleanup. So knowing your reuse assessment and coming to terms with a facility, especially if it's being closed, with the EPA and the state and the local community, as well as the federal facility that currently owns the property, is very important for these reuse assessments. And you really have to think about, these can become very big. They can make you do a lot of work, but the scope and level of detail should really be site-specific and tailored to the complexity of the site. For us, we really get concerned when sites have a lot of waste materials on the surface or contaminated soil, or, you know, if there's a landfill or a cap body there, we have to be careful about what is that property is reused for and make sure that the remedy is not impacted. So those are things that we look at a lot in these reuse assessments, and you have to think about when property might be transferred and reused in different ways. But generally, groundwater use is determined independently from land use. However, the need to protect that groundwater may drive what we decide to do with soil cleanup. We may look at leachability numbers to make sure that what we're cleaning up in the soil, in addition to being protected for whatever the reuse is protective so that the contamination does not leach down into the groundwater and continue to cause a problem for us. And it's very common with these federal facilities, we have a lot of operable units. So you might have to do multiple reuse assessments to look at different operable units and where they're located. And we kind of talked about this a little bit already. If you have an operable unit that's going to be surrounded by what's changing to residential property, even if it's not going to be residential, you might want to look at that differently than one that's really in the center of an industrial part of your site that we all think is going to stay industrial, say maybe become business park or something like that. So you probably have to do multiple reuse assessments for these large federal facilities with multiple operable units. So I'm going to hand it back over to Emmy here to talk about the Department of Energy facility called Fernald and what it has become.
Sure. So we're on slide 15. This is an example we wanted to talk about. It's a Department of Energy site, DOE, at Fernald. It was a former uranium processing facility in Southwest Ohio. And from that, it's become a really huge resource for the community. It's now publicly accessible, ecological preserve. It offers wetlands, prairie, forest ecosystems, and it's of huge value to protecting wildlife in the area. So to go from, you know, uranium processing with all the industrial businesses that were associated with that, and to be able to move forward through the cleanup process to reach a point where reuse was a very big focus, and reuse will take a lot of cooperation and coordination across all of the agencies involved. So in this case, you know, DOE, EPA, I believe the state was also involved in the discussion. I don't know all of the specifics, but more than just the agency folks, it also required engaging with the community extensively as far as what their anticipated views were for this land, what it could be, what values were held for the area, and trying to work together through the cleanup process to be able to achieve that endpoint as a group would be with only one, you know, be it one agency or one community group trying to make something happen, you can't get as much traction when all the groups are working together to this final goal. So we really want to highlight areas where reuse has been successful, and the Fernald Preserve is just one great example of something that has worked out really well as far as cleanup goes. Rob, did you want to add anything on that example?
No, but there are some things at Fernald, like there was a lot of waste left in place and capped, and that landfill is still there, and there has still been able to develop other parts of the land. This is a great example of where the cleanup of groundwater is separate, really, from the reuse of the land as a nature preserve. The cleanup of groundwater when the Fernald cleanup was complete enough for the facility to be completely shut down was still ongoing. I think they have had a lot of progress, and their pump and treat system, I think, has been changed in the past few years. But this was a facility where they really had a very large, active groundwater treatment system ongoing as they went through this process of turning it into a nature preserve. So just wanted to point out that the groundwater can happen very independently of what's going on at the surface.
That's a great point. Thank you, Rob. So now this site has been converted to about 900 acres of ecological preserve. So that's a great result from that effort, understanding that groundwater cleanup often, you know, takes a lot longer than the soil cleanup that we do at federal facility sites. All right, we can go ahead and continue to the next slide. Are you on that, Rob?
Yep. So this is a follow-up to the reuse directive changes in future land use. And so it is important to keep in mind that our assumptions and designations will change as we go through this process. We may be working with a facility, and very common with the military facilities that they have operational ranges, and we're not engaged really on the cleanup of operational ranges. We wait, and if any contamination comes off the range, it has to be addressed. But as long as the military is still using that range operationally, it goes on with that process, with that purpose. However, if they change and they say, you know, we don't need this range anymore, we're moving to a different process, or we're going to consolidate and use a range at a different facility, then we have a whole different change in land use assumptions. It's not a range anymore. It might still be an open area, a recreational area, or an industrial or commercial area, but you have to reevaluate it and go back and look at it. So before you sign a ROD, you may have to do lots of additional documents or revisions to standing key documents just in case these land use changes happen while you're going through the process. And it's also important, oh, you know what, there. I couldn't figure out where the rest of my bullets were. I had to keep tapping through them. After the ROD signature, you're going to have to go back and look at some of these remedies, and the normal place that we look at these remedies is in five-year review. So if we have chosen a remedy jointly and we have the record decision in place and we are going through our normal five-year review because we left some waste in place at that particular operable unit, that's when we're going to capture these land use changes. It happens at private sites where we see land use changes. It also happens at federal facilities, and that makes us go back and look at, is this property still being used the way we thought it was? Is it still staying industrial? Or is it now changed to something recreational, and we need to look at that scenario differently? So now we're going to do a little apply your understanding, and I'll let Jean take over to set up the poll.
Okay, so on this particular slide, the screen will have changed, and you'll have one of those interactive poll questions now appearing on the bottom half of your screen. So I'll just remind the audience that as we walk through this case study, we'll ask you to think about the question that's being posed, what is the anticipated future land use for this site, and then simply click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct. Of course, as a group, you'll need to decide and then submit one answer for your particular location. So as we're reading through this, we have a hypothetical laboratory, Laboratory X, which is located on a military base, and it is currently under federal ownership. The area is part of the Superfund site, and it is primarily used for laboratories, office space, and parking lots. So the military base is planning to transfer ownership of the lab and its associated buildings to city ownership in the future. And so given what you know, what would you describe the anticipated future land use for this site? Now, there are options below, including residential, agricultural, industrial, recreational, and then for those of you who are refraining from participating, you can simply not vote. I'm seeing a distribution in answers coming in here, so I'll give you just a few seconds more. They seem to be leveling out, and I'll go ahead and end the poll. We'll turn on the view. And Rob or Emmy, can you talk through what the anticipated future land use would be for a site in this situation?
Yeah, so this is Rob. You know, when you have a lab like this and it's going to be transferred, as we say, to the city and the city buildings, our general assumption is going to be that the city's going to use it as a lab, or they're going to use the existing buildings as office commercial space, or maybe even industrial storage space. We've seen this a lot at other military bases and facilities where they have these great buildings already put up. Especially a lot of our military bases have logistics centers and maintenance centers, and cities love to get their hands on these and municipalities in general. And then they have ready-built maintenance and logistics facilities for themselves and ready-built office space. So normally when it's something like this that's already in industrial use, our future land use assumption is going to be that it's going to stay industrial use. However, some people are thinking, well, we don't really know that, and so maybe it would go residential use. That is very true, and that goes back to Emmy mentioning early on that when we make these decisions on our future land use assumptions, it's good to have everybody involved in the discussion. If they're transferring the property, we really should know who wants to develop it and how they want to develop it. Maybe they do want to tear all these buildings down and turn it into a recreational facility, just an open park. Or maybe they were already getting a lot of encroachment from neighborhoods, and it's primed to become residential real estate. But knowing what your realignment and closure commission is working on, knowing what your communities are interested in, that's very important. Maybe this is a lab site. We don't give you any of this information, but there's always the possibility that there was some waste left in place there, and we can't let it really become residential. So those are things we need to be aware of. But I think in general, when we have an industrial property, whether it's a federal facility or a private site, and we look at our future land use assumptions, unless there's a driver that we think is going to change that land use, we'll say, well, we think this is going to stay industrial. I'm going to go on to the next slide here. Okay, this is another kind of apply your knowledge slide. So, Gina, I'll let you set up the poll again.
Okay, so again, we're revisiting that same question about the anticipated future land use for the site with those same four possible land uses, residential, agricultural, industrial, and recreational. But this time, in the case, we have land along a river, which is part of a federal facility Superfund site, and it is currently under federal ownership. In this scenario, the area was primarily used for chemical processing activities and is being cleaned up under CERCLA. The city, though, is interested in developing the land for hiking trails. So how would you classify the anticipated future land use for this site? And it does look like the audience is kind of zeroing in on one particular answer. So remember, you just need to click the answer below. We do have a few people who are attending on mobile devices, and I know that the polls don't quite work the same for you. So if you're unable to click the circle, you can always type your answer into the Q&A window if you'd like to play along with this question. And I think we'll go ahead and lock down those responses here. And Rob, let's talk through what the results and answer would be.
Well, I think I would agree with the great majority of people here. It looks like over 95% think that this would go recreational. The city is definitely looking at hiking trails, and we would call those a recreational scenario and want to set up our exposure assumptions along those terms. However, I noticed there's a couple people that said, well, maybe it'll stay industrial, and that is a possibility. But if we go that route, we'd have to make sure that it stays like that. We'd have to have all the institutional controls in place to control that. And there are a couple people that said residential, which that's something we got to keep an eye on. We've seen a lot of these former industrial areas that have been redeveloped into recreational areas. And at this point, we're seeing them in a lot of cities, and then people will look at them and go, well, I sure would like to have something nearby where I could live on that property or along that property. And river property is prime property to be redeveloped these days. into residential property. So that is something we have to keep an eye on. And if we're leaving some kind of waste in place, definitely the five-year review process will come in very heavily here as we look at, hey, is this staying recreational? Has some portion of it been given by the city to a developer? Has the zoning changed? All those sorts of things. All right, very good. So I'm going to go on to the next slide here. More about the reuse directive. So one thing we don't think about very much, but the reuse directive really does talk to us about this, and we should take into consideration, is there a lot of times when we clean up a site and then it's kind of left, and when we come back and revisit that site at a five-year review stage or during some annual monitoring stage, we find that it has been used for inappropriate activities. Illegal dumping is very common on Superfund sites. It happens on federal facilities too. It's sometimes we'll see off-road vehicle use, especially of these big open landfills and things like that. And if we can find something that matches with what the community wants to do and keeps it in the public eye more, some of these illegal activities are seen before they really get going, and we can really have an impact and extend the remedies protectiveness. So, for example, some of the examples we've given you of like Mount Trashmore, that's a site that, you know, it's obviously a landfill and it's got a cap on it, but by redeveloping it for recreational use and hiking trails and mountain biking, you know, we're able to see if somebody, very quickly the community is going to know if somebody gets there and starts using it for a different type of off-road activity that damages the cap underneath or for some kind of illegal dumping because somebody says, it was a trash landfill before, I should be able to just dump stuff here. When we have the community engaged and reusing a site appropriately, we have a better chance of seeing those sorts of things. So that this second bullet talks about that even more. And then we don't think about this as much at EPA's. We certainly have put a bigger focus on that these days, is if we can reuse a site in some way, it really can benefit a community. Quality of life improvements, you know, having a recreational facility that you didn't have before can really make a big difference in a community. And even financially, it can make the property more valuable. You know, there are a lot of Superfund properties, and federal facilities are the same way. Once they get transferred, they're not really much on the tax rolls. And then if they are redeveloped in some way and there's a reuse of them, they can get on the tax rolls and really help out the local community in that way. So both these quality of life improvements and financially, and then of course we can get commercial development of some of these properties that really contributes to the whole community financially as well. We're going to talk a little bit about institutional controls now. Certainly institutional controls, they play a vital role in what we're going to do on a site and whether or not you can have good ICs on a site. Local governments can play a big role once this property has been transferred for federal facilities. The local government is really going to play a big role in identifying the ICs that are available, whether it's zoning or whether you can actually put in a deed restriction or something like that. And you should consider them as you're going forward with what your future land use will be and what your remedy will be as a result. For federal facilities, even if it's staying on in federal property and within a federal agency, we're still going to work with that federal facility. We use a term called land use controls or LUCs, which is more a combination of engineering controls and institutional controls. And for most of our facilities, we're going to work with them to implement a land use control implementation plan, or maybe we'll do a land use control remedial design to capture all of those land use controls and institutional controls for a piece of property that stays on within the federal family. So those are very important documents that we work on. We should be working on a little bit pre-ROD and then a lot of them post-ROD, ROD being a record of decision. And then if they do get transferred out of federal property and into the municipality or to a state or to even another agency, we have to be very careful that the institution controls we set up will still keep that property protective and that the remedy will stay in place and not be disturbed by the use. I'm going to hand it back over to Emmy for this next slide.
All right, so we're about to switch gears from land use to on-site, off-site determinations. I just want to check in with Jean. Have we had any other questions come in on land use before we switch topics?
Oh, yes, we have. So it's a great time to stop. Let's start with this first question. I think you guys touched on this, but let's go back. What happens in a case where we have a federal facility who has a certain assumption about land use, but it doesn't reflect all of the current land use? What role or what actions could a state agency do other than just documenting this discrepancy? Do they have another course of action when the federal agency has failed to take all land use into account?
Well, I'm hopeful in this conversation between the federal agency and the state agency that other parties are contributing to the discussion as well, be it EPA, assuming EPA is also involved, and the community. So we're hoping that land use determinations take the community's concerns and aspirations for the land into consideration. In this conversation, I would be interested to know if the federal agency feels that one way and the state agency feels another, if there is some balancing that could happen in consideration of what the community is providing as far as input. Ideally, our anticipated land use is going to determine the amount of remediation that's done. So that is, I mean, that's a huge, you know, crucial point in going through the CERCLA process for a site. Unfortunately, I can't speak to, like, a specific process or a specific regulatory hammer that the state could use in that instance, but I think a broader conversation, a more informed conversation with buy-in from all of the affected parties would be valuable when there is already some disagreement between the federal and state agency. Rob, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, if it's a CERCLA site, we certainly do have the use of dispute on primary documents if we feel like they're not taking the proper land use assumptions into account when they're doing a risk assessment, and that's flowing into a remedial investigation report and a feasibility study as primary documents. If we don't feel that they have done the work to prove that that is the future land use and their assumptions for their risk assessment are incorrect, then, you know, we're not going to agree with those documents. And so then we're going to have a place where we have to come together formally in dispute and work that out. Hopefully you're doing that without having to go to dispute. But that's one way in a CERCLA world. You know, we're not going to approve the primary documents. We're going to get to a place where a record decision is put out by a federal agency that we cannot agree to and cannot sign. And that becomes a problem if the remedy is not going to be protective for the future land use assumptions. But you do have to go back to the earlier question that if they have designated a piece of property as industrial and that's what they say they're going to use that property for, EPA and the state can't say, no, you're not going to use that industrial. We want you to build housing there. That's not our role to play. But it is our role to make sure that the assumptions they're using for their risk assessment and flowing into their decision documents are appropriate.
Okay, and Rob, you just said a magical word, a dispute, and I want to circle back to that because a number of people are asking very specifically, what is the official process or what do you do when you have a disagreement between two federal agencies in terms of the future land use?
So I'll start in responding to that. Two federal agencies, you may disagree on the land use and still be able to come to agreement on what the land, you know, what scenarios you should use for your baseline risk assessment. So one agency may think, you know, this might be developed for recreational or residential use. The lead cleanup agency may say, no, this is absolutely going to stay in our ownership and we're going to maintain it as industrial use. And you can still decide to have a more conservative baseline risk assessment based on a hypothetical resident or something to that nature. So there's flexibility where each agency can keep their stance, but yet you determine where the compromise is to be able to move forward with cleanup, assuming that agreement can be found or compromise can be found, right? If it's just an outright where we want to use an industrial exposure scenario and the regulatory agencies, I'm just making an example here, don't agree, then it might have to go through the avenue Rob was describing with a formal dispute process. Rob, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, so our MPL sites definitely have federal facility agreements in place. There's only one facility that doesn't have one right now in the country. So that's going to lay out where if the future land use assumptions are not in agreed to by the three agencies, the state, EPA, and the federal facility, then those do have to go into a primary document at some point in order to produce a risk assessment and to move forward and screen alternatives and then choose one to implement at a site. So if we can't come to agreement, we will look at these primary documents under our federal facility agreement, and those are the things that we can go to dispute on and try to work out. And if it's the future land use assumptions that we're going to dispute about, well, that's very important, and that's where you'd have to work that out. And it is a formalized process that's laid out in federal facilities agreements. If you're working under some other kind of agreement, you know, if it's not an MPL site and you're working under a RCRA permit or maybe a state consent order or something like that, you usually still have dispute laid out somehow in that permit or in a state consent order. It's not something that EPA would be involved in, but certainly the state and the federal agency would have to work that out as well. So there are formalized ways to do that if we can't come to agreement about land use assumptions. I just cautioned that, you know, we said this before and I've already repeated it, but we can't, as regulators, tell them how to use their property. They are going to use their property in a way that's appropriate for their mission, and it is their job to decide what that mission is and how they're going to use their property. So, you know, even if we think, go back to the example we have here with the land along the river and the city wants to use it for hiking trails, say it doesn't get transferred and the federal agency keeps hold of it and decides, you know, they want to keep it the way it is and not use any hiking trails. Neither the state nor EPA would be able to tell that federal agency, no, you have to give that property up and make it into hiking trails. That's just not the role we get to play.
Okay, I think what we'll do is we'll take one more question in the time that we have now, but we do have additional breaks for Q&A later on, so I encourage the audience to continue to send your questions and comments in. If you don't hear your question brought up right now, don't worry, it's in the queue. We'll just try to get through as much as we can, though, later on. And this one, it's a long question, but it gets into compensation because of land use selection. So if this is beyond the scope, just feel free to let me know, but I will try to paraphrase what they've written in here. So they ask, when you're assessing the current use and you're predicting future changes of use, they question how the process deals with zoning district hierarchies. For example, when you have a commercial property that has an entitled right to develop multifamily homes or daycares or nursing homes, they really wanted to know, if you're seeking to limit future uses, does this wind up creating some sort of compensation or compensable taking of an existing property right?
So this is Emmy. My first reaction to the question is that is, for federal facility sites, we're talking about land that is under federal ownership, so I don't believe you would consider that as any sort of taking or a situation regarding compensation, because the landowner is the federal government, essentially. Rob, do you have a different take?
No, that would be my take, too. You know, if the land is contaminated and has to be addressed and that means that they can't, and they don't want to clean it up to a residential number, and so there's no takings there. That's still under federal ownership. If it transfers to a private entity, then that kind of changes, but I think that's beyond the scope of what we're talking about in this particular webinar.
Okay. All right. Well, again, as I said, I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and move on, but I see more questions are coming in, and there were others in the queue, so we will pause again for questions. But Emmy, if you'd like to carry on with slide 21, please do.
Sure. So we're switching gears now to on-site and off-site determinations, and we'd like to start by doing a short group poll. So Jean, can you lead us through this?
Sure. So this group poll is a little bit different than the others we've been working with. In this case, we're posing a question to you as a group, and we'll ask you to each type in a reply in the space that you see in the lower left half of your screen. And the question is specifically asking, what challenges have you dealt with in your on-site, off-site determinations? So you'll see a box that asks that question on the bottom, and there's an empty long line where you can click your cursor and type your response in. And when you're done, just hit the Enter key or click that Send button. But you'll be able to see responses from other participants as they start coming in. And this feature will allow you to actually vote on responses that you have also faced. So we're sort of crowdsourcing you all to get a sense of the challenges that you've encountered with these types of determinations. So as answers start to appear in the box in the lower half of your screen, if you see something that also was a challenge for you, I'll encourage you to just hover your cursor over the space where the answer was typed in, and you should see a plus one appear. And so you can actually click that plus one and sort of cast a vote and agree with that person and say, yep, we had that exact same problem. And so what we'll do is allow these answers to sort of shake out, if you will, and the ones that have the highest vote will sort of start to settle at the top. But you can scroll through the responses as other people are typing them in and see some of these challenges. So I'm already starting to see some common threads that certain people have felt that they face the same challenges. We're starting to see some commonality here. So we're trying to offer those of you who like to type, you've got an option to type in your response. And for those of you who would prefer to let the others type in and simply agree, yes, that was a challenge for me too, you can just scroll through some of those responses here. Emmy, it does look like one of them is just clearly been, from what I'm looking at, the votes that are coming in, a problem for a lot of people. And I'll read this one off, and I don't know if you want to scroll through and talk about some of these, but one of our participants mentioned that evaluating whether contamination originated from a neighboring facility or the facility with which they were working on has been a big challenge for them. Do you have anything to add to that one?
No, I think that's a common challenge when you're determining the nature and extent of contamination. You hear the phrasing, well, is this on-site or is it coming from off-site to the contamination you have. We won't touch on that too much today, but I'm hoping it will help a little bit in understanding how we draw those lines.
Okay. Another one that I'm seeing in here is the use of states' environmental covenant statutes for land use controls.
Yeah, that one's interesting to me. Rob, I don't know if you have thoughts on it. I personally haven't experienced this challenge, but I'd like to hear a little or learn a little bit more about it, either after this course or in a separate conversation. Rob,
We have states that have environmental covenant statutes, and certainly for the private sites, it's something that we will use as long as we can determine that environmental covenant statute has been applied consistently across the state. We've had a few issues in some states where we don't feel like it's being applied consistently, and so that makes it difficult to rely on as an institutional control. With federal facilities, that's a lot harder because a lot of those environmental covenant statutes don't really apply to active federal facilities. They don't have things zoned out. They don't have tax tracts of land laid out like that because they're exempt from that. But if the property is being transferred to a private entity, then those environmental covenant statutes do come into play, and we have used them on that end as part of the ICs that help us decide whether or not we can choose a remedy that's protective. So it just kind of depends. I will say that every state's covenant statute is not the same. You have to look at what's being done by your state and how it's being used and whether it's applicable to your site.
All right, and then I'll just comment on one or two more here, Emmy. Another popular one is the formerly used defense sites or FUDs.
I'm going to tap on Rob here to see. I think you might have a little more experience with FUDs than I do. And their challenges with on-site or off-site determinations?
Yeah, so FUDs are a specific challenge There aren't that many of them that are MPL sites. There are a few that have become MPL sites. You know, these are properties that are almost all already transferred out of federal ownership, and many of them were transferred long before the Superfund law was even written and in place. Some of them even transferred way before RCRA. And so, you know, the federal government still has the liability for any waste that's left behind, but a lot of these sites have been reused for industrial purposes, and finding the line of when the facilities that were there that were not federal contaminated the property and what when the federal property was transferred out of our hands, that's very tough. Formerly used defense sites are also they're not overseen by EPA as much unless they're MPL sites, so it falls to the states a lot to make sure that they're cleaned up correctly. And usually those are either under state programs or under the RCRA program for the state. What else can I say about them? You know, the whole program is really overseen by the Corps of Engineers, and it has fallen to the Corps to clean up these sites. And there are the few that have become MPL sites. You know, it's a little tougher, and what happens is the Corps represents the government as the PRP that has to pick up that piece of it, and then the other people that we can find that use the site or currently own the site become potentially responsible parties. And I'm really sure how to look at that as far as on-site, off-site. I mean, unless you're doing something on that FUD property and building a cell there or something like that, anything you do there is probably going to be taking waste off-site.
Yeah, I noticed that in looking through the entries, and thank you to everyone who voted and provided specific examples. It's really helpful. There's actually a few topics that maybe aren't specific to on-site, off-site, but as part of our Federal Facilities Academy webinar series, we touch on, like, for example, the groundwater point of compliance at property boundary. We have a groundwater webinar that would probably be helpful for answering that. Compliance or application of ARARs, that we also have a webinar coming up specific to the topic of ARARs. So if we didn't get to your entry, I really encourage you to look at the other webinars we're going to be providing, and it might be that your answer will be made available there versus in today's presentation.
All right.
You want to try to hit on any more of these, Jean and Emmy?
Well, one question. What about the groundwater point of compliance at a property boundary?
Oh, I don't want to
big one.
Yeah, I don't want to steal thunder from the webinar that's under development for that one that's going to come up later. You know, I will just say that in general, there's a different world between CERCLA and the other programs, and so our point of compliance is not the property boundary of a military facility, for instance, or a Department of Energy facility. Those are huge property boundaries, and the boundary can be a long way away from the operable unit, and so we wouldn't say that the point of compliance is at the property boundary. What we tend to say is within the waste unit is the point of compliance. So at the boundary of the waste unit or the operable unit would be the groundwater point of compliance, where we would want to be able to restore groundwater to beneficial use and to the proper cleanup number, often the maximum contaminant level under the Safe Drinking Water Act, but a state may have stricter limits than the MCLs, and so it's not at the property boundary. It's really at the boundary of the operable unit or the waste unit.
Okay. We did have people kind of chiming in that they had confusion that on-site and off-site, did that mean the property boundary or sort of shipping the waste on-site or off-site? So you kind of hit the – I think you guys commented on this, that there's just some confusion over that terminology here.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and continue through the next slide, and we'll start to clarify what we're referring to with something being on-site or off-site and how it applies under CERCLA. It's a great segue, actually, to the next topic. So we're going to start with off-site determinations under CERCLA, and to understand off-site determinations, you need to know what the off-site rule is. So the off-site rule applies to any CERCLA response action that involves off-site transfer of a hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant, in short, CERCLA waste. So if you have CERCLA waste leaving your site, going off-site, then the off-site rule will apply. And CERCLA waste may only be placed in a facility that's operating in compliance with RCRA, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or other applicable federal and state requirements. So CERCLA waste can't just go to any landfill. It has to be an approved landfill that can actually receive those hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants. Let's look a little more closely at the OSR purpose. So why are we doing this? Why are we keeping such track of where CERCLA wastes are going? Or essentially, we don't want to make a bigger problem in the future. We don't want to make a new Superfund site by sending waste from one Superfund site to some other location. So the whole purpose of the off-site rule is to make sure CERCLA isn't contributing to any present or future environmental problems. So what actions are affected when you're looking at off-site determination? So any remedial or removal action that involves the off-site transfer of CERCLA waste that is conducted by EPA, the state, a private party, or other federal agencies. And any of those parties who are moving CERCLA waste off-site, this rule is going to apply. And as long as the work is being done under CERCLA, if it's, you know, Superfund lead, meaning EPA is the lead, or if it's a federal facility where that other federal agency is the lead, if it's being authorized under CERCLA, then the off-site rule is going to apply, and those CERCLA waste from the site that's being cleaned up can only be sent to a U.S. off-facility site. So very important to keep in mind if you're shipping waste off your Superfund site. Come back for a second. One thing to keep in mind, though, one exemption to the off-site rule that you might be dealing with, usually there's an exemption provided for lab samples and how those are ultimately disposed of. So one thing to be aware of if you're dealing with the disposal of lab samples from RIFS activities at your site. With the OSR rule, it's important. It's not just a single rule, like, oh, you can only send CERCLA waste to these certain facilities. It also lays out criteria and the procedures for how those facilities are identified as being acceptable for receipt of CERCLA waste, and it also has procedures to notify a facility when they are identified as an unacceptable location for receipt of those waste, with procedures on how to get back on that, you know, get off the naughty list, so to speak, so that a waste facility can continue to receive waste. So there's a lot of useful information when it comes to the off-site rule. And we have one example. Rob, do you want to talk about Spring Hill Landfill?
Yeah, so this is the classic example of an off-site facility that will take waste. So this is just a standard Subtitle D landfill. You can see that it's run by Waste Management, who owns a number of landfills across the country. This particular one is getting waste from Tyndall Air Force Base, which is an MPL site, but it's also got waste from other CERCLA actions that have happened. I know that this landfill was used during the Deepwater Horizon incident as they took waste off of the ocean, and some of it was shipped out here and held and dealt with. And so this is what we think of when we talk about off-site rule. This is a permitted RCRA landfill. The Region 4 on-site rule coordinator has certified and continues to certify as this landfill gets used to ship waste from Tyndall Air Force Base or from other CERCLA actions. And they're also getting waste, you know, just in general from the community. And so they have the waste disposal fees and but this is the what we really think of as the off-site rule is to make sure this facility is okay to use. And so every time they go to use this facility to ship waste from a site, they will check with the on-site rule, the off-site rule coordinator, which in Region 4 and in most all the other regions is located in the RCRA division, and make sure that this facility is still in good standing And as long as their permit is in place and they don't have any permit violations, then they'll be considered in good standing. And they'll get that permission from the off-site rule coordinator, and then they'll be able to ship waste to the facility as long as it meets the terms of that facility as a Subtitle D facility. So you can see this is just kind of the standard way we think of this being used. We have some more examples we're going to show you, but I like this one because it's the normal. It's not the exception to the rule. And we do have exceptions to the rule we're going to show you. And, you know, one thing to think about with the off-site rule is if you're shipping your waste off-site, you really have to think about what that means for you, because in this example, this place is 68 miles away from the Tyndall Air Force Base MPL site, so it's a significant distance to truck waste, which is a significant cost of shipping it and also then paying for it to be disposed there, and those are things you have to take into consideration as part of your remedy evaluation. Now you have a lot of trucks taking waste to this off-site facility. So those are all things that come into play as you choose your alternatives and choose what remedy you're going to select. But like I said, this is the standard example, and now we have some not as normal standard examples to talk to you about. Go ahead, Emmy.
Sure. So the example that Rob just talked about is for a landfill off-site that's accepting CERCLA waste, and they can receive it. They, you know, the OSR coordinator says yes, yay barely, they are able to receive this waste for disposal. So that is a clear-cut example. This next one is a little maybe not so clear-cut, which is important that we go over it. So you may have an MPL site that has a permitted facility located on it. So remember, under CERCLA, if for on-site activities, there is an exemption from having to obtain a permit. And we'll talk more about that in the following slides. But in this example here, if you look at the top right hand of the graphic on screen, you see a green line. And this is the outline of the Hanford site in South Central Washington State. And that little red star in the center is the location of an effluent treatment facility that treats wastewaters from Hanford. Now, a lot of these wastes come from groundwater remediation activities, and some condensate coming from across the site. So if you look at that green outline, there are four MPL sites that make up the Hanford site. This is located in one of them known as the 200 area, but it's a RCRA permitted facility. So as far as the CERCLA cleanup goes, this facility, though geographically on the Hanford site, is considered off-site for remedial actions, and it's the state regulates that facility through its authorized RCRA program as part of a permit. So this is one of those weird examples where you have a facility, it's geographically located on an MPL site, but for the purpose of remedial actions, it's considered off-site, hence the use of a permit for regulating that facility. So I'm going to pause for a second and see, Jean, did we get any questions or thoughts on that?
Not that I can see just yet, but we can come back.
Okay. The first example, very clear cut. This next one, we're still talking about off-site, but if you look at it, you know, just reasonably is not the word I want to use, but your intuition is like, well, that's located on site, right? There's the Hanford site, there is the facility, but it's treated as off site for the purposes of CERCLA remediation. So let's keep on with this topic and get into permit requirements. So as I mentioned, permits are required for CERCLA work conducted off site, but not those activities conducted on site. And this is right out of the NCP in CERCLA section 121, where it speaks to those local permits that might be required, are not required under CERCLA for those on-site activities. However, a permit would be required for any response activities conducted off-site. So just something to keep in mind as to why a facility might be permitted and treated as off-site. Well, because under CERCLA, there's an exemption to having to obtain permits for on-site activities. So moving on to the next slide, we have an example of a dispute that actually took place on one of our sites with a specific question. When is a permit required? What is on-site really mean? And what are the implications of that? So this is an example taken from the former Weldon Spring Ordnance Works. It's located in Missouri. I believe it's, 30 miles west of St. Louis. And it's about 17,000 acres of land. It was under mixed ownership. The Army acquired it in 1940 to produce TNT and DNT, so explosives essentially, as part of the World War II effort. And it was deactivated in 1945, so about 5 years of operations. And after that point, it was transferred to state and local groups. It got listed on the NPL in 1990, and a Federal Facilities Agreement, or FFA, was signed in 1991. There is a separate Weldon Spring site that belongs to the Department of Energy. For this dispute, we're talking about the Army site. So let's get into what happened with this disagreement. So in 1994, Missouri invoked a dispute regarding the state's authority to require permits for the incinerator, contaminated wastewater treatment, and stormwater runoff activities that were described in a CERCLA record of decision. So the Army responded and asserted that permits are not required for on-site CERCLA activities, and they were not going to get a permit for those activities. Missouri also argued that EPA's view of on-site was overbroad, since the response actions would eventually result in extended off-site discharge beyond the on-site area. So if there's a air emissions or water emission or discharges that would leave the site, the state was arguing, well, then that should require a permit because the impacts are going off-site. They're leaving, you know, the on-site boundary. At least that was the argument that was presented. This went to formal dispute, and it eventually got raised to the level of the Region 7 Regional Administrator for resolution. So it went through that entire FFA process of a formal dispute, starting from the project team to mid-level managers and so on, until it was actually brought up to the Regional Administrator's level for resolution. So going on to the next slide, in the RA's letter, so a written letter is required for the Regional Administrator to provide their decision on the dispute resolution. It was stated in there that there's nothing in the statutory language that requires substances that are discharged or released from response actions on site that they must remain on site to qualify for the permit exemption. So the EPA Administrator at the time, Carol Browner, stated that, you know, EPA is interpreting CERCLA Section 121 and looking at all that information to say, well, even if there is some eventual emissions or discharges that are leaving the site, you know, because of subsequent migration beyond the site boundaries, that doesn't mean that a permit has to be required. That wasn't the intent of Congress when providing for that permit exemption under CERCLA. So essentially, the state's argument was not agreed with, and it was agreed that a permit was not required, or I should say it was decided that a permit was not required for these on-site activities, again, from the incinerator and the wastewater treatment that was happening on site. You know, if that happened, if it was to be interpreted that way, it would essentially, you know, what would require a permit then? Most, you could argue that any CERCLA remediation that dealt with emissions or wastewater discharges would require a permit, and that was not the intent of CERCLA as it was passed. So that's how that ended as far as disputes go. So on-site work does not require permits, but that doesn't mean that the lead federal agency can disregard the requirements that would apply. So you still have to meet with ARARs, particularly if you're dealing with land, you know, waste disposal. RCRA requirements are going to be an ARAR in that capacity and will need to be complied with. So anything that deals with the generation, transportation, or treatment and disposal of hazardous waste likely will have RCRA ARARs that apply. So, for example, if you have a landfill on site, that's going to have to meet a lot of those RCRA requirements as ARARs. I'm going to jump right into the next slide on our next example of a landfill. You know, Rob talked about the Spring Hill landfill that was located off-site and waste was shipped there. But we also have situations where a landfill might be constructed on a federal facility site for the purposes of receiving CERCLA remediation waste. So one example of that is the Hanford Environmental Restoration Disposal Facility, which is known as ERDIS for short. So in your figure that you see on the screen, that is the Hanford site, and this the red circle identifies where the landfill is located on site. So this landfill was established under its own record of decision, and other Hanford record of decisions will state that ERDIS is considered on-site for the purpose of that remedial action. So this requires quite a bit of discussion and coordination between the Department of Energy and EPA. You know, we all need to be on the same page there. And we also had to make sure that, DOE was still required to ensure that ERDIS met the substantial requirements of RCRA. Even though it doesn't have a permit, it's not a RCRA-permitted landfill, but it still has to meet those substantial requirements. Not the administrative requirements, not the paperwork portion, but the substantial requirements of the regulation. There was an instance where I believe DOE was doing some work at the site that EPA did not agree that it was remediation waste. And there was an assumption from DOE, well, we can just send this waste to ERDIF. And EPA's response was, well, that facility can only receive CERCLA waste. This is not a CERCLA action. It's not being done under CERCLA authority. You're doing it under, you know, a separate program. We won't permit, or we're not in agreement that this waste should go to the CERCLA landfill on site. And it did not go to the landfill ultimately. So, again, still need to have coordination between your lead cleanup agency and regulatory agencies when considering, for the purposes of that remedial action, whether a landfill is considered on site. Our federal facility sites are so large, often the landfill is not going to be in the same OU or the same operable unit as where the remediation is taking place. So it's important to have that language standardized if possible and used across your records of decision as it makes sense to do so. Jumping to the next slide here on on-site determinations. Just the specific language that you see in our regulations talks about the aerial extent of contamination and all suitable areas that are in very close proximity to the contamination necessary for doing the response action. So I can imagine that phrase, very close proximity, it doesn't say 1 square mile. It doesn't say 500 feet. It doesn't specify a distance. So when you say very close proximity, what does that mean exactly? And I know, at least from my personal experience, that that has led to very long discussions, disagreements, perhaps arguments between the regulatory agency and another federal agency on what that means. What is on-site? What is off-site? And the whole purpose of using this term is that you want to move waste across or outside the boundary of an operable unit when it makes sense to do so. The whole purpose of being cautious with whether something is on site or not is so that you're not introducing contamination to areas of the site that might be clean. So definitely a lot of disagreement there depending on how that phrase close proximity is being interpreted. But I would suggest you work through it with your site teams, which will involve your regulatory agencies, your lead cleanup agencies, to make sure that everyone is on the same page. And it might take a while to get to that point where you're all in agreement, but if you don't get on the same page, it can might result in formal dispute, which can take very long and just push out your schedule tremendously. So something to work with or work through together with your site team. Rob, did you want to take us through this last apply your understanding slide?
Yeah, so this is another little poll here, so we're going to need Gene to step up. But as you look at this and answer the poll, I want you to think about the language from 40 CFR 300-400E. It's the aerial extent of contamination and all suitable areas in very close proximity to the contamination necessary for implementation of the response action. So that's how we define on-site. So kind of look at this. Here we have an operable unit that road dead ends into that operable unit, and at the intersection, and we're not giving you any distances here, but the intersection across the way there, kind of catty-cornered, there is an equipment lay-down area. So a lay-down area that you're going to need to put equipment down to be able to operate the remedy that you're going to implement at Operable Unit 1. So just kind of look at that and vote, please.
All right, and then in the bottom half of your screen, you'll be able to see that question. In this scenario, would the lay-down area be considered on-site for the purposes of an OU1 response action? And you have three answers you can choose from: yes, no, or sometimes. So I'm starting to see those answers flying in. We'll give you a few more seconds. Again, if you're unable to participate in that online poll, you can always type in your particular response into the Q&A window. That should appear on the right side of your screen. For those of you who've been chiming in with additional questions and comments, we see them in the queue, and we will pause again for another Q&A break here in just a few moments, so don't worry, we will get to you. All right, I feel like we're starting to shake out into a leveling of those responses, so I'll go ahead and flip the switch here and close the poll, and let's see if we can talk about what is the answer in this particular scenario.
Wow, okay. Yeah, we're pretty evenly split here, about 40% for yes and 40% for sometimes and about 20% for no. In general, I would go with the sometimes because we don't give you a whole lot of details in this example. Certainly, you are going to need areas outside your operable unit sometimes to be able to stage equipment and to be able to move equipment. You may want to stage an area off-site of your operable unit where you're going to wash down equipment because you don't have space to do it in your operable unit. And you're going to need a place to wash down that equipment and collect that wash water and make sure that it's not migrating off-site. But there may be other times where you have plenty of space within that operable unit. It looks like a big kind of rounded off square, and you may have plenty of space to work in one end of it while you're using your equipment storage in the other end of it and moving around as you implement your remedy. So it really depends on the site specifics, and I would go with sometimes here. But in general, you places that are nearby that you might use for equipment laydown areas are going to be okay, and so I would also say that yes is an acceptable answer. I think folks that are voting no are you're kind of hedging your bets a little because you don't see distances here. You know, we may be showing you an intersection of two interstates, and there may be 10, 20 miles between these two places, and you really wouldn't want to say that an on-site equipment laydown area is 10, 20 miles away from your operable unit. So it's understandable if you looked at that and had that interpretation.
All right, excellent. And so I believe we're going to move on from this particular scenario and get to our summary. Emmy, is that correct?
Yes.
Yep. So just really quickly here before we get to the final chance to ask questions, a quick summary. You know, land use determinations are a very critical part of remedy selection. How we decide to clean up and what we decide to clean up to is very integrally tied to what we decide the land use is going to be for the site that we're working on. If it's going to be industrial or residential or commercial or recreational or maybe even, you know, there are different parts of recreational we might look at, then those are things we have to take into consideration as we work through our baseline risk assessments, and we have to take into consideration as we decide what we're going to clean up for the soil and sediment in the area. We really want people to consider reuse as much as possible in remedy selection. We're at a place where a lot of federal property has been transferred back to communities, and we see that there will be more federal property going back to communities. Some of it will be very difficult to reuse, and some of it may have to be a very specific reuse that is appropriate for the remedy that we've selected and for what's left at that facility to do. But we really encourage people to consider reuse as much as possible and talk about it openly. You know, if you're working on a site and they are saying, hey, we think we're just going to use this for industrial use in the future, but it would not cost that much more and take that much more time to get to a residential cleanup, that's something to think about and talk about openly between EPA, the state, and the lead agency, and bring in your community and think about, well, is that piece of property on the edge of the federal facility? Is it in the center of the federal facility? All those things come into play. The offsite rule was really designed to make sure, in simple terms, that the mess we're cleaning up doesn't cause a mess somewhere else. So think about that as why we have the offsite rule. We don't want to contribute to present or future environmental problems just because we move the waste from one place to another. We don't want to create another Superfund site. Admittedly, we are usually putting waste in other disposal facilities, which are not going to be used for anything but disposal, and if they get redeveloped, it will not be in general for residential use. But we don't want to cause a problem where we have waste that is then moved somewhere else and becomes uncontrolled and contributes to risk to human health and the environment. And then just the examples we've shown you about requiring permits for on-site activities. In general, CERCLA at MPL sites, you're not required to get a permit to implement your remedy for those functions to make the remedy protective of human health and the environment. It's just not how we're set up in CERCLA. I will say, honestly, in practice, I've seen federal facilities that already have partial permits or permits for other parts of their facility go ahead and extend that permit or meet the permit requirements and do everything that the state wants them to do. Sometimes that's an easier way to go for the facility, but it doesn't have to happen, and it's not a requirement. So I know I've had states talk to me at other times where they've said, well, yeah, but they did it anyway. They got a permit. And they're certainly allowed to do that if they want to, but it's not a requirement under CERCLA. So that's kind of the summary where we are right now. And, if you've got something else to say, go ahead. And other than that, I guess we could move to questions.
No, I think that was great, Rob. I say let's take some questions in the time we have left.
All right. So with that, let me start in. I think we'll look back first at the Hanford examples that you had shared. There were a series of questions that came in, as well as some clarifying statements about the on-site, off-site determinations that took place there. So one participant mentioned that the TSD units that are permitted under RCRA, they're done that way because they are used for non-CERCLA work as well as CERCLA waste management, and so the RCRA regulation is because of that, not necessarily because it's off-site. So they just wanted to clarify that if they had gotten that waste from a different Department of Energy facility, it would have been a, quote, off-site as far as they were concerned. And then the other questions that we've had come in regarding Hanford are just, it seems like it wasn't, there were inconsistencies is what they were seeing. So this one participant says that she's confused as to why the landfill on-site had no permit, but the ETF was off-site and it needed a permit. And I don't know if that is perhaps tying back to what that other participant had clarified regarding the RCRA waste. So I don't know if maybe we can go back and do a high-level summary of those two examples, the landfill on-site, which had no permit, and the ETF, which was off-site and it needed a permit?
Sure. So with those examples, remember in the Hanford landfill example for the ERDIS facility, I started by saying that it was established under a CERCLA record of decision with the intent of receiving CERCLA waste. So non-CERCLA waste would not be able to go to that disposal facility. Because it was being done under CERCLA, the permit exemption applies. So there was no requirement to obtain a permit for that landfill. However, the lead cleanup agency still needs to meet the substantial requirements of, you know, the ARARs that would apply from RCRA as far as waste disposal goes and any other applicable and relevant and appropriate requirements that would apply as well. So that is for the landfill portion. For ETF, that treatment facility for wastewater, I thank you to the person who wrote in about the clarification there with it being a TSD, and it being considered off-site was not the reason for having a RCRA permit associated with it. Very good clarification there. It's simply that facility is not limited to only receiving CERCLA waste. It is a RCRA permitted facility that was able also to take condensate from ongoing activities at the Hanford site and being regulated under RCRA. So I hope that clarifies things a bit.
Thanks, Emmy. Can you go back to the first example that you covered in the on-site, off-site? I believe it was the Spring Hill landfill. One of the participants just wanted you to revisit why it was considered off-site.
Sure, I'll click us there. Rob, do you want to start talking about that?
Sure. Let's see. I'll let you get back to that picture.
I'm trying. Sorry. Lots of clicks.
So it's clearly not part of the federal facility, and it's also not associated with any operable unit. It is a separate off-site facility many, many miles away that is permitted under RCRA and is operated by a separate entity. So we consider shipping waste there off-site. And that facility does have off-site rule acceptability. It's something that the facility pursues, and these privately owned landfills and other disposal options, they pursue off-site rule acceptability from the regional off-site rule coordinators. So it has pursued that to have it so that they can take those kinds of wastes, not just from Tyndall, but as I mentioned, this one also took stuff from Deepwater Horizon and I believe has taken waste from other Superfund sites as well, as removal sites have had waste go there. So it is the clearest example of off-site. It has off-site rule acceptability. It's not tied to the facility that we're shipping from in any way, and it's certainly not part of any operable unit, and it has an existing separate RCRA permit for disposal at that facility.
Okay. Can we move on to the next example and take a look at that one as well? So the Weldon Spring Ordinance Works. What about this one? Why was this one considered off-site?
Well, so I'll speak, even though Amy talked about this, and I'll talk. So this is not off-site. This is an example of an on-site remedy. Where everything they did was on-site, the wastewater treatment system they built for this, the incinerator that they used at this site, all of these were on-site activities within the facility itself, the facility boundary, but also either within or very close proximity to the operable unit that was being addressed. And so this was considered on-site and did not need to have a permit. So it's the exact opposite of the Spring Hill landfill. Amy, you can fill any details in.
No, I think you hit it right on the head, Rob.
Okay. Our next one is a simple clarification. They want to know if on-site and off-site rules apply only to Superfund cleanup sites, or does it apply in other regulatory programs?
So the off-site rule is specific to managing CERCLA waste. So that is specific to Superfund. And on-site determinations, I believe they're also used in other programs, but there might be different jargon and definitions used outside of Superfund. Do you agree, Rob?
Yes, exactly. It is the off-site rule is a purely CERCLA rule and only applies to CERCLA cleanups.
Okay. We had another question about implementing LUCS, L-U-C-S's, to address off-site contamination. Can you discuss how you implement the LUCS to address the off-site contamination?
I would start off by responding that that is a very big challenge, especially if a federal facility site is under federal government ownership. when you have contamination that has left the site into land that is, you know, owned by different parties, it's much more challenging to be able to implement institutional control because you don't have as much or any control over the land. So I would say that's actually a very big challenge for federal facilities and something that, at least at EPA headquarters, we try and work with our regions in addressing and working through because it is a big challenge. There's not a quick fix. Hopefully you can work with your local governments to help get their cooperation, you know, highlighting that this is for protection of the public, human health, and the environment, and get them to be able to help you with that. But it is a big challenge.
Okay. We have another question here, and this participant was simply, I think they were talking about a challenge that they faced, but they typed it in, so perhaps you can comment on it. And they wanted to talk about how you restrict property, for example, roadways that do not have a deed on which you can record an EC. So I don't know if either of you have encountered that situation or have had to work on restricting property, like roads that wouldn't.
Can you repeat that again? I'm sorry, I missed the last part.
So the comment was about restricting property like roads where you don't have a deed on which you could record the EC. And I believe the EC would be an environmental covenant, right?
Right. So it's not private property that can have an environmental covenant recorded on it.
Right.
It's a public road.
Right.
So it's a right-of-way controlled by the state DOT or an entity like that.
Mm-hmm. Have you encountered that?
Any thoughts? You have encountered it, Rob?
No, I'm agreeing with you. I don't think I've encountered that exactly. I mean, in terms of a federal facility, you know, if it's a piece of property that they paved a road on and its prior use was something else, say a firing range or, you know, a pesticide disposal area, and then they paved a road on top of it, we wouldn't get an environmental covenant per se because we wouldn't be able to do that, but we would still have ICs in our remedy even if our decision was to just leave the road in place and that there was no impact to groundwater and so the road served as a partial cover or cap, something like that. But we would still get that into our remedy as part of the remedy and require the land use controls and an implementation plan or land use control remedial design document, but I don't know that we would get an EC on that. And so for a private entity where there's a road been put on part of their property and so now it's a right-of-way for the state, that's one I haven't run into exactly. I think what we might do is require them to still clean it up if we couldn't put an EC on it so that we couldn't have a viable institutional control that would influence your remedy decision. If you can't put in ICs, then those can't be part of your remedy, and you have to choose something else that's protective.
Okay. And they did chime in here to clarify that this is basically adjacent to a federal Superfund site, and the roadway is actually serving as a cap.
Okay. So try to figure out a way to write that into your remedy and then have the ICs recorded in some way, even if you can't do an environmental covenant. There may still be a way to work on that.
All right. So we have another question, and this one is they're trying to get back to the RCRA and CERCLA site. So if you have soil is taken off of a CERCLA site, but that soil does not exceed RCRA limits, does it need to go to a RCRA-permitted facility? Because they've encountered situations where their cleanup goals can be below the RCRA hazardous waste concentration limits.
So if
even
you're
if
doing,
oh, go ahead, Amy.
Go for it.
So if you're doing a CERCLA cleanup, it's still CERCLA waste. So its ultimate disposal facility that it goes to must meet the off-site rule. So if you're shipping CERCLA waste off-site, then it's got to go to a place that meets the off-site rule, and you don't just because it's below the hazardous waste number doesn't mean it's not still a waste that would cause a risk for your scenario at your site, your exposure assumptions. So it would still, then it would just go to an off-site rule acceptable facility that is not a hazardous waste landfill, but is still a disposal facility that has off-site rule acceptability.
Okay, Emmy, anything to add to that one?
No, I think that was perfect.
All right, well, how about this one? For sites where groundwater plumes are at the very edge of the federal facility site, would you restrict the adjacent property? And if so, how would you actually do that?
So if you have a contaminated groundwater plume that is leaving the boundary, the physical boundary of your NPL site, and there is potential exposure, you know, potential risk of exposure to, you know, the environment or to people, then yes, efforts should be done to address that contamination and to prevent exposure. It may depend on where exactly this is happening. If there is are not groundwater wells or, you know, other really nearby exposure routes, then it might be a little easier to deal with. If you have contamination leaving your site directly to a drinking water well that people are using every day, then that requires outreach efforts to let people know that there's a risk and then coordinating to address or remediate that risk as soon as possible. You know, EPA looks very closely at where human exposures are happening, particularly if it's leaving a site, and we really, really want to get those exposures addressed as quickly as possible. So not knowing more specifics, I'm not sure what other advice or tips to offer.
I would add a little bit that just saying you're at the edge of the facility and that the fence line is not good enough. If this is a plume whose source area where the actual operable unit and waste unit is some distance away, then you're way beyond the edge of the waste unit and you're in the aquifer. So just because it hasn't gotten to the property where someone may be drinking right now, you're in the aquifer, and under the NCP, we require restoration of groundwater to beneficial use. And in general, what that means, most of our aquifers are drinking water, potential drinking water aquifers, and so we're going to make you restore that aquifer within a reasonable time frame to beneficial use, which is usually MCLs, the maximum contaminant level under the Safe Drinking Water Act, or if the state has promulgated a more protective or number, we would require that number. So just being at the facility boundary doesn't mean a whole lot to me. Is the plume beyond the waste unit, then you still have to restore that aquifer. And as Emmy said, if there's still a potential for that plume, if groundwater migration is not under control and there's a potential for that plume to continue migrating and impacting private property and private wells within that same aquifer, then there's still a driver to do something about it on that end too, not just restoring the aquifer, but actually keeping that plume from spreading. And it doesn't have to have spread today. The potential that it will do so is enough of a reason to take an action. So there's kind of a two-prong answer to that.
Okay. I think I'm going to take one or two more questions. I think that's what we've got time for before we close things out today. Really quickly, somebody commented earlier in the presentation when you were going through possible use situations that EPA has a brownfields program and sites get cleaned up under that are done privately. And so they just wanted to know, why aren't federal landowners allowed to use or take action to clean their sites up for an industrial use?
So I would respond to that statement or question and say, I think everything's on the table, but you have to look at all the information that's available for your site. So if, you know, what really is the anticipated future land use? If after discussions with your stakeholders, all the federal and state partners, if there's tribal concerns as well, after all of those conversations, does industrial use make sense? If so, then it absolutely can be considered in moving forward to have that industrial use scenario in your baseline risk assessment and then move forward through the CERCLA process. If there's disagreement or if there are, you know, factors present or information available that points to a different kind of land use being more appropriate, then industrial land use might not be the appropriate anticipated land use for that site. But I wouldn't make the assumption that it's never on the table, because we have a number of federal facility cleanups that are based on industrial land uses in the future. So hopefully that addressed the question. It really is a site-specific decision and should be informed through discussions with all of your local stakeholders and cleanup agencies.
All right, great. And I think we're going to close out with a question asking for guidance on this topic. I think that kind of segues really nicely to potential resources that we may have available. So, Emmy, can you highlight what resources are available on this topic for the audience?
Sure. So one of the materials that should be under the related URL section is a reference list. So there we'll have links to the guidance documents we discussed today, as well as other useful documents on this topic. So I would encourage you to download that and click on those links if you feel that you want to go more in depth into this topic. The three we talked about today, the Land Use Directive from 1995 is a really big one for EPA, and then the offsite rule itself is really helpful. So I would highlight those as being maybe the first two you would want to look more closely at.
Okay. All right. So on that note, Emmy, any final thoughts to leave the audience with before I walk through our closing instructions today?
Sure. We just want to thank everyone for joining us today. Really pleased with the turnout and looking forward to any feedback that you can provide. We're always trying to make these webinars more useful. Hearing the discussion today has been really informative. So if there's any other thoughts you have on this webinar, please let us know. And I'll give you one final pitch for our future webinars. I think I saw a few questions regarding community involvement requirements for federal facility cleanup. That's our next webinar on October 1st. So you can definitely sign up for that and join us again. Thank you, everybody.
All right. So with that, let me walk through a few final reminders for today's session before we close things out. So a number of you had asked me questions earlier today about how you could get a certificate if you were in a large group, or what were the requirements to document your participation. So now is the time when we will walk through those final reminders today before we close out today's live broadcast. I'll remind everybody that you can find information about cleaning up hazardous waste sites on our website at cluin.org. I hope that you currently subscribe to our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month and will highlight webinars such as today's. As Emmy noted, there are a collection of resources, including a participant manual, some of the reference materials that she was just discussing, as well as a handy little tracker that you can download to use to sort of keep track yourself of the courses that you're participating in as part of this series. You'll find those materials on the seminar resources or links page. Again, look under the middle right of your screen under related URLs, click the seminar resources link, and then press the Browse To button to open that on up. I will ask each of you to fill out the online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, but it's also the way that you'll get a seminar certificate. So as we highlighted at the beginning of today's session, that this is a series that is made up of 11 online public webinars that anyone can attend, and then one classroom delivery, which will be open to a limited audience. As far as the online webinars go, they'll be available for you to attend live. You'll also be able to replay them online and participate through the online archive. But in order to get credit for any one of those 11 webinars, whether you're there live or you replay the recorded version, you simply need to submit the feedback form, which is available in the webinar, whether it's live or online. You'll find a link to the feedback form in each one of those webinar environments. And once you complete that seminar feedback form, you'll then have access to a certificate for that particular seminar. So I strongly encourage you all to fill out that online feedback form. You'll find it right now under related URLs. So for those of you who are in a room with a group of people, that's all that you need to get is the link to the seminar feedback form, and send that link to everyone who joined in the room with you. Each person can fill out the feedback form on their own and get their own certificate to keep for their own records. And then for those of you who are eligible to take that in-person classroom training, which will take place next year, if you can attend that one in person, you'll be able to get an Academy certificate if you do all of the online sessions, either live or replayed, and then attend that in-person classroom training. So I'll just remind everybody, to get a certificate for this session, you need to fill out that seminar feedback form, and please make sure that, A, your own email address is entered correctly on that feedback form, otherwise we can't email you the certificate, and then you check the box at the bottom of the form that will certify you are here for the session, either replaying it or you were here live, and then as soon as you send your feedback form results in, that will give you access to one of those certificates that will look something like this one. So, again, I want to thank our instructors who took time out of their busy days to join us for today's session, and I want to thank the nearly 190 people who joined us from all over the country for today's first session in the Federal Facilities Online Academy series. So we'll go ahead and close out today's live broadcast. As stated earlier, I'll send you all an email as soon as the archive is available. We should have that up in just a few days, and I hope that we'll have you on for our very next seminar in the series as we continue on in October.